you mentioned the Buc-ee's example. That's the perfect one. I can see every future Buc-ee's having a bank of chargers, because Buc-ee's, you go in with the expectation that you're going to spend 25 minutes, because it's going to take you that long to pick out what beef jerky you want. And so you go and you charge while you're doing something else. And it seems like the perfect opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Autonocast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors.
And I'm Alex Roy, the founder of the Human Driving Association and co-founder of the finest consultancy in automotive transportation, AI, and robotic strategy, Johnson & Roy. And today, we have a guest I wanted to have on the show for 3 or 4 years who... You may not know by name, is absolutely one of the most insightful and brilliant people regarding the history of technology, transportation, and also one of our favorite soft drinks, Coca-Cola, Ted Ryan, the in-house historian and heritage manager at Ford Motor Company. Welcome, Ted.
Thanks for having me on. The actual title is Archives and Heritage Brand Manager, but I love the fact that Ford treats heritage as a standalone brand, the same way that we would a Mustang or anything else, because the heritage is so important to the company.
I'm glad they do too, because your history at Ford, you've been there 10 years, is that correct?
Seven years. And I was at Coca-Cola for 21 years before that.
Okay, so it appears recently in social media, I've seen rumblings that careers as a historian are not as common, because history... research, history, and academia is just not as popular as it used to be. And so I feel like there's the historian of science, Ludwig Fleck, once said that, you know, progress is never a straight line, and the notion of a straight path to success is a myth. And I think it's really important that people understand the history of technology back in time, because it provides a guide to understanding what's happening today. So our conversation today was inspired by something you said in a call years ago, which was that the history of gas stations and its relationship with the Coca-Cola company is relatively unknown. And I started sniffing around this, and I could find not much information about it. So before we get to Ford, which we really want to talk about, could you talk to us a little bit about the relationship between the first gas stations in the early 20th century and the Coca-Cola company?
I will. And a lot of it is going to be framed in the terms of gasoline. This will tie back to EVs as well. Gasoline was not a much sought after item. It was just like kerosene or heating oil. It was just a thing. And you would get a 50-gallon drum. It would be outside a hardware store or a pharmacy. And you'd pump out a gallon into your glass jar and take it away. It wasn't until gas stations became stations. They became service centers, which is around 1908 to 1914 was that magic time period where suddenly you get established gas stations. Well, gas became a commodity. And the way that the gas stations began to make money was partially at the behest of the Coca-Cola company, where Coke established its petroleum channel 1916-ish to go sell coolers to gas stations. And we had these amazing profit guides in the Coke archives, and you would flip through it, and every Coke was sold for a nickel. It only took about a penny and a half to make that bottle of Coke. So the 3.5 cents are pure profit. And that was pretty much split between the bottler and the gas station. So the gas station is essentially making a penny and a half, 2 cents per bottle sold, and they can make more money selling bottles of Coke or peanuts than they can gasoline. Because pretty soon there's a gas station at every corner. So the gas prices themselves equaled out, and gasoline became a loss leader to try to sell the peanuts and the Cokes and oil changes and the other things that the service centers would provide.
So let me understand this. What year did the Ford Model T come out?
1908.
Okay, so 1908. I'm a hip guy. I have money to burn. I buy a Ford Model T. Where would I walk me through the process of finding a place to buy gas and buying the gas? What is the exact process? How would I even know?
That's a great question. I did this research beginning about a year and a half ago, trying to anticipate the EV charging network. Okay, so how did the gas station spring organically to life? Well, part of it was the ubiquity and the cheap price of the Model T. Developed in 1908, it sold for about $850. Inflation calculate that, and that's about $25,000 in today's dollars. But with the mass assembly beginning in 1914, the price dropped down to about $250. Put that in inflation calculator, and you got a $12,000, $10,000 car. So people are buying cars. How do they get the fuel? And all the earliest efforts pre-1908 were what I described. You go to a hardware store, you go to a pharmacy, you go to anybody who's going to sell you kerosene that you're going to use for your lights to illuminate your house is also going to have gas. And you get a gallon of gas, you pump it out. Then you got later the gravity-fed gas equipment, which allowed gas to be pumped directly into the cars. And believe it or not, for safety reasons, a lot of those were right on the curb. So you're pulling down Walnut Avenue, and there's a gravity-fed gas pump in the little shack nearby where the guy will collect the money, and you then get your gas that way. The whole concept of the service center came about kind of gradually, but not. Chevron bought the National Service Association chain in 1914, and that's when you saw the explosive growth, and suddenly you're getting service centers. People wearing these attendants, wearing their matching uniforms with their little name, Chet, is on the cover. And they've got the Coke machine in the corner. And they're also offering oil changes and air for your tires. And they're making money on all of those. But the commodity itself was gas.
And really quick, just really fast, because you mentioned something that I think is really an important piece of the puzzle, but that might be kind of counterintuitive, which is you were saying people would go and buy kerosene from this, right? These stores used to sell kerosene and pharmacists, right? And because kerosene was the main way that you lit your house, until it wasn't. And so, right, so that's a factor too, is that these stores that were selling kerosene and gasoline at the same time, they lost the kerosene market, right, around this same time. And then that sort of opened the opportunity for service stations to kind of steal the rest of that business. Is that right?
100%. And when you look back at the history, it's the why. And the why, the driving force behind it was actually the ubiquity and the low cost of the Model T. You have enough vehicles being sold. I don't have the number in front of me now, but it's like in the United States in 1908, there were only like 8,000 registered vehicles. It was a really low number. I'm probably off a little bit. I don't have that note in my. But the following year, we're selling 1,200 Model Ts a year. And a couple of years after that, we're selling 10,000, 100,000 Model Ts a year. You get the demand for the vehicles springs up, and you know, necessity will answer a created demand. So the gas stations pop up. And Kirsten, I see you got your.
Yeah, you mentioned Chevron's role in this, and you talked about explosive growth. Can you quantify that for us? Because when I think of explosive growth being tied to EV stations, it still doesn't feel that saturated yet. So how, during that period of time when Chevron made that acquisition and then just started popping up all these service stations, what are we talking about? Like, how saturated was the marketplace and how short of time?
It happened, and it went from the coast to the middle. So I had a long call, and you guys should have on the Chevron archivist. He's a fascinating cat as well. He's pretty interesting. Chevron's first gas station, 1908, the same year as the Model T. Their big push was 1914, the same year we did the assembly line. When they purchased the National Supply Group, National Supply Stations, I'm reading a memo on my computer right now, within Chevron, and they're buying thousands of these service centers and standardizing them, which is the other thing too. The role of standardization, and we're seeing it play out in the EV market with the chargers and everything else, the role of standardization is the role of you know, knocking down the nails that are poking up until you get a smooth board. And it's that standardization that Chevron and the other petroleum companies began to apply to this industry, to the point that you get the standardized nozzles, you get the standardized gas pumps, you get the standardized experience. The same way with the Model T, you're getting a standardized car. And the same way with Coca-Cola, you've got a standardized homogeneous product. So it started slowly. It started in the thousands. And I'll send you guys the memo from the Chevron Board of Minutes, Board of Directors Minutes, so you can see the purchase documents. But it started mainly in California, and then it grew and across both coasts. And keep in mind, you also have the Rockefeller Trust, Standard Oil, on the East Coast doing the same thing that Chevron's doing on the West Coast.
Why did it start on the West Coast? Because I think, of course, the Model T, and I immediately go back to Ford's roots and where it was located. Is it just because of Chevron's footprint on the West Coast that is how that evolved?
Yeah, and it started as I probably use that word incorrectly, because the oldest operating gas station I can find is actually in Pennsylvania, you know, where Titusville, where oil was first pumped out of the ground too. So, you know, you've got the East Coast, West Coast. My knowledge is stronger on the West Coast, which is why I went to their reference, and the Chevron archivist and I've traded back notes about ubiquity of the gas stations and Chevron's roles and the homogenization of that experience, which was supreme. And keep in mind too, the oil companies, they all know what they're doing. You know, the petroleum companies, they would call themselves. So they're, you know, the standard companies are watching Chevron going, hey, wait, let's figure this out. And let's figure out how we apply this on our coast. And then Coca-Cola is looking on the side going, oh, wow, here's an opportunity to get more coolers in place. Because the Coke makes the syrup, which is then sold to the bottlers. The bottlers are incentivized within their local community to get more coolers in market. Whether they're putting it at a gas station, whether they're putting it at a laundrette, whether they're putting it at a hair salon, the more coolers on the ground, the more Cokes you sell, the more Cokes you sell, the more money you make, and the more money your business eventually makes.
So today, all this is, this history is super relevant today because obviously there's this big question about, and there's multiple companies taking different routes about, like, how involved should automakers be in the, you know, energy supply that goes into the vehicles. And so the historic legacy obviously is that, you know, the auto industry very much decided not to get into that business. And the way you describe it, there's maybe some hints in there at why, like the fact that from the very, very beginning, just about, or from at least very early on, the gasoline itself was a lost leader, that it was a commodity business that no one was making money off. That right there seems like a pretty good clue at why car makers did not want to, you know, expand into this other line of business. Even Ford, which was famous for vertically integrating into, you know, rubber in Brazil and all kinds of other vertical integration. Am I right about that? Is that the main reason? Were there other factors that went into that decision to say, you know what, like, we're going to leave the fueling to others?
We tried to push it onto the dealers, and we did. Dealers could have gas pumps, and some did, and some opted in and some opted out. And so we're seeing history rewritten. I mean, we're watching it happen in real time now, because we're watching the EV charging infrastructure mimic what happened a century earlier, but in a different way. But Ford did not want to get in the oil business. We didn't want to get in the tire business. We left that to Firestone. What we did is we pushed standardization on the dealers so that we required dealers to hold X amount of parts in-house so that they could get them when they want them, so that the Model Ts could be serviced. And we begged them to put in gas pumps. Most didn't. I think we only have an instance of like less than 1,000 out of the 15,000 actually put in the gas pumps, because there wasn't money in it. You know, how much money do they make on a gallon of gas now? They make it on the refining of the gas, but the money isn't made in selling the gas. It's made in selling the Coke and the Doritos.
I'm wondering if you've looked at pre-Model T and the first electric cars, and how that energy was sold and how that even worked. Because this would have been in like the late 1800s, right? The first electric vehicles, I think, were kind of around at that point. Was there a business model? How are people, quote unquote, fueling their electric cars at that point?
It's fascinating. And my knowledge is only after 1906. Clara Ford actually drove an electric car. And electric cars in large part were marketed to women because you didn't have the odor, you didn't have the noise, they were quiet. You could start with the push of a button. You didn't have to hand crank a Model T. And at Fairlane Estate, which was the home of Henry and Clara Ford, in their garage, they had a turntable. It would hold 13 vehicles. and they have four charging units for her electric fleet. They were built into the garage in 1914. Ford and Edison were working to develop electric vehicles about that same time as well. We never successfully got it off the ground. Edison's battery wasn't as good as advertised, and it was doomed for failure immediately.
But history sure does rhyme, doesn't it? Yeah.
You know, and that's the beautiful thing is, well, the trick is learning from it. And the trick, I mean, every word I'm telling you has been communicated via different meetings and different presentations to Ford management as we're working through the how to best work with our dealers, how to best get the electrification networks needed for charging. I own two battery electric vehicles, and I took a group to the Top of the Thumb last week, and we miscalculated, and we ended up on the side of the road in a truck stop with gas, or charging the car, making us 20 minutes late to get home for a dinner that we had planned. So, you know, I've lived it. I've had the range anxiety, and you see the infrastructure in place, and there's nothing worse than pulling up the app, finding out that two of the four are not working and one is occupied. And you're just hoping you can get to the one that's working and unoccupied in time.
Speaking of like lessons learned, then you outlined the history of like how Clara Ford charged her vehicle. I'm wondering how others, granted, it wasn't ubiquitous at the time. It's not like there were millions of electric cars running around, but how did people aside from the elite, you know, charge their vehicles? And is there anything that was successful that could be, you know, pulled and used today in terms of approach, not technology, but approach?
Yeah. I'll send some ads as a follow-up to this, but the way that the electric vehicles were advertised is to charge at home or to charge in special charging centers. Detroit Electric was a successful battery electric vehicle manufacturer, and they were associated with Detroit Power. And so there were individual places that you could go that you could get charged, but most of them, it urged the charging at home, just like Clara Ford was doing. And the range was so limited too, but the destinations were limited. You know, how often did you need to go more than 20 miles in a day? And some of the early ads, I'm thinking from the teens, would say, you know, we'll get you to the market and the store and home, you know, so that was your expectation. And you didn't think about driving to Cleveland because that wasn't going to happen in a BEV. You'd take a train. Why would you even take a car for the most part?
And there's no interstates at the time anyway.
Right. But, you know, you're going down pitted roads. So it was the level of expectation was so much lower that it could be met at home or with these limited charging stations. And Detroit's the only area I know for sure with this. And I know because of the research we've done with Detroit Electric Vehicle Company and with Henry and Clara research that we've done. I couldn't tell you how they charge it in New York.
I mean, it's fascinating too that the electrical grid really only it really by the time it really was fully kind of close to built out in a way that everyone, you know, or a lot of people could charge at home, you know, the gas engine was already sort of leaving battery technology right behind. So there's a little bit of an interesting thing there where if that time differential had been a little bit different, right? If it had taken a bit longer for the gas engine to really kind of hit its stride the way it did and the electric starter and things like that. And you know, we built out the grid more fully and it was sort of easier for everyone to kind of charge at home. It's possible. I mean, it's likely things would have gone the same direction they did anyway, just because the gas engine technology development was so dramatic versus batteries. But that, you know, it's an interesting sort of like hypothetical, right?
Right. And well, the poor kerosene market and same thing happened to them. And keep in mind too, that Henry Ford was late in life. Was successful late in life. He was in his 40s already. He had worked for Detroit Electric and met Thomas Edison there. You know, he and he, oh my gosh, how many power plants are there in the Detroit area that Henry Ford built? He loved electricity. He loved power supply. His own Fairlane, that estate, is powered by a hydroelectric power plant that he had built on property.
And he and,
not anymore, but it was at the time.
He and Edison were buddies too, right? They would like to go camping together and stuff. Yeah.
What year did Ford begin exporting cars to Europe?
Europe, believe it or not, very early, 1904, first cars imported into London.
What was the propagation of or the conversion of gas fuel sales from hardware stores into actually gas stations in Europe. Did that parallel the American expansion?
Oh, I haven't done that research. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. So I know US because I focused on it exclusively for the last few years, but I haven't looked at Europe yet. I would think that something similar would have happened, but I don't know. In fact, I know that Coke wouldn't have had a role in it at that point. But you would anticipate that it would be similar, but I know the U.S., not the European.
So as a historian, there are, I'm sure that you'd agree that there are inflection points in history in like every country and every technology, there's inflection points, a year or a span of time, which everything changed. So is there a single moment in time, a single decision, which the fork of the road where gas was just going to kill EV no matter what? Or was it a
1914, the modern assembly line sucked the cost out of building a car. You could build a car and you could sell a car for today's equivalent, $10,000. At one point, the Model T represented 57% of the cars built in the world. We had that much, that much purchase power, that much sway. So, and that's also the same year that Chevron purchased the gas station empire then. And you had the chicken and the egg both being hatched at the same time in 1914. Prior to that, anything could have happened. You could have had steam. Steam could have taken over. There was early hydrogen. I mean, there could have been any number of different propulsion systems. But gasoline, and ironically, you got left-hand drive because of the Model T. Before that, you might see middle drive. You might see right. And Henry Ford did that so he could drop his Claire off at the curb and she wouldn't have to walk through the mud in the street. So you got right, the Model T in 1914 and the assembly line changed everything.
And not to give too much credit to the boys across town, because I know we don't always love doing that, but the 1912 electric starter engine starter motor that Kettering put into Cadillacs, that for the first time, right? I mean, and it's hard to imagine what crank starting a car is like, but people would break their arms, right? If you didn't crank that right, I mean, it was not just physically difficult, but it was dangerous to do. And so that was literally one of the reasons that people bought EVs, right? It took something that was painful and difficult and dangerous out of that ownership experience. And I think that Kettering invention in 1912, I think, was the first on the Cadillacs. And then it kind of expanded from there, right?
100% agree. And Henry Ford avoided it for ages. He was so stuck in the mud with the Model T, didn't want to change it. But yes. And then nature abhors a vacuum, and the establishment of GM as competition to Ford helped push and it also pushed technology changes and the V6 and the competition heated up, just like we're seeing the EV competition heat up today. So
Chevron, 1914, Chevron buys the National Supply Station Network, right? And so at that point, Coca-Cola was already very popular at these stations, right? So at what level, at how high a level was Coca-Cola?
Actually, Coke was 16. It was just after this.
Okay.
So it took the establishment of a standardized experience, and then Coke jumped in and saw the opportunity.
So at what level, at how high a level was Chevron or Standard Oil talking to Coca-Cola? Or Ford, were CEO talking to CEO talking to CEO?
Are you asking if they were like sitting down at the clubhouse, charting out their domination?
Well, according to great man theory or great person theory, like sometimes a single person or a single dinner among people can change history. And so, every time I go to a car show in Scottsdale, like all the vintage stuff is a Coca-Cola gas station sign. So
right.
That's what precipitates this question.
That happened later because the business model for Coke was that they sold syrup and advertising, and then the bottlers did the hard work of putting it in a bottle. The only customers of Coca-Cola were the bottlers. The bottlers had multiple customers, and they would sell locally to their local chains. It wasn't until you began to see the national chains grow up in the 40s that Coca-Cola would develop account managers who would oversee an entire account. for Tenneco or for name your brand, for BP Gulf, you know. So those account managers came later. But it, at the beginning, it was done on the local level. And frankly, that local sells to local much better. What you described with the, and those Coke signs are classic. It would say Coca-Cola sold here, and it would say there would be a hole on the side or space to write 5 cents a gallon. You know, so those classic Coke signs were what we call dealer aid. So the bottler would purchase a dealer aid, would put it out in front of the service center to attract the attention of the price of the gasoline and that Coca-Cola was available there should you happen to stop. Brilliant marketing, just brilliant. I mean, the Coke folks knew what they were doing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because I hadn't really thought about the power of the bottlers, which, you know, it was kind of up to them too. I mean, obviously Coke had the product, but the bottlers were really the ones making the inroads. So were there any local legend bottlers that like really pushed this idea forward, or did they do it sort of as a collective group? You know, they all kind of caught on to the sort of service station idea at the same time.
So we're going to go way in the weeds, but there was a group called the Coca-Cola Bottlers Association that met every year. And they're the ones that they came up with the standardized Coke bottle, which by the way, was 1915. So everything is happening in this tight little decade. So your classic Coke bottle patented in 1916 or patented in 1915, went into production in 1916. And suddenly it's going into these standardized gas stations, which are putting standardized pumps, putting standardized gas into standardized Model Ts. You know, this, the whole thing just became a self-fulfilling prophecy where they all came together. But they, at the Coca-Cola Bottlers Association meetings, they would talk about new sales strategies. I can do it. I can talk about it today because I'm working here. How do we get a Coke machine in the school? You know, high school for the kids to be able to enjoy during break. How do we get one at a luncheonette? And at the same time, the only place Coke is selling to customers is the fountain trade. So as the burger shops are coming up, White Castle just celebrated 100th anniversary. So Coke is putting a fountain machine in every White Castle and then later every McDonald's. And, you know, the ubiquity of the product is what set it up and the standardization of the product. A Coke is a Coke. No one can get a better Coke. That was the old Andy Warhol quote. And, you know, no amount of money can get you a better Coca-Cola, but any amount of money can get you a better car or a better bottle of wine. So that 5 cent standard price for the bottle, the gas station's making 2.5 cents off it. The bottler's making a penny and Coke is getting the smallest margin. They're getting like an eighth of a cent, but they sell a lot of syrup.
Yeah. I'm curious if you see any reason, right? Because one of the strange things we have, right, clearly a need to build out more and more EV infrastructure, charging infrastructure around the country to continue to fuel adoption. And yet, you know, these businesses seem really hard. You know, keeping the chargers up and running has been really difficult. There's all kinds of issues. And yet what you don't see is sort of how we made this work the first time around, which is, right, you know, the companies that are actually making money sort of having an adjacent business to fuel it. Where are the Cokes in EV charging? So I know like Buc-ee's is sort of maybe the closest example to that, because I know they've gone into big EV charging and obviously they're making their money, you know, off of Coke and Doritos. But with EV charging, it seems like that opportunity is almost better because you have people, you have a captive audience for at least, you know, a good 30 minutes. It seems odd to me that you don't see, I'm curious, you know, with your historical background here, what are the differences? Why don't we see that business model evolving here?
Yeah, I've asked myself that 100 times because as with another couple, we're sitting in a, it wasn't even a truck stop. It was a place that sold rental trucks, but it was the only charger within 50 miles. And I had to charge in order to get home. So we sat and there was nothing to do. So we basically sat there for 25 minutes watching the meter run. And I don't know why Sonic, you know, if you go to a Sonic, you're sitting there for 25 to 30 minutes minimum. Why don't they put a charger there? You know, it's gotta be the cost, but I don't know. And I'm speculating. I always like as whenever I know a definitive fact, it's a fact, but I speculate that the cost, the startup costs must be difficult to bring in the amount of money needed to pay off that investment. Otherwise, you'd see people doing it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, especially, you know, some locations, it's really expensive to get, you know, that high voltage service. And it's not like you can, it's not like gas where you just have trucks drop it off, right?
You don't see this high voltage service at a Sonic with those lights going off?
Oh, I'm sure there is, but then you'll have to build more. And it's just, it's right. And you're right. Because like with gas, it's the upfront cost is relatively low in a pump or whatnot. And then you just have a truck that comes in and brings it to you from your supplier. It is a very, like the cost structure of that kind of business is definitely different between electricity and gas.
Yeah. McDonald's isn't smart. And the fact that McDonald's hasn't jumped in, you know, or the McDonald's is smart, and the fact that they haven't jumped in with something like, or Waffle House, a place that a quick serve, in the old Coke terminology, we called them QSRs, quick serve restaurant, where you know you're going to spend 25 minutes. And yes, Kirsten, you go.
Yeah, well, so speaking of that, though, some of the first Tesla superchargers, which is absolutely a real estate play, you know, along the freeways, were at Carl's Jr.'s. Like, granted, there was more real estate to play with because, and the route that I'm most familiar with is going from Arizona to either LA or San Diego. But it was like, if the Chargers were always right there by a Carl's Jr., you know, not much else going on. But I don't know if that was driven by Carl's Jr. or, hey, this is the real estate that's available with the energy needs that we have. Let's just put it here. So I don't think it was, you know, at least from what I know, driven by that business necessarily, and more of the proximity and convenience of where it was, availability.
I'd be fascinated to know why, and to know the underpinnings of who made those decisions and why. Because you mentioned the Buc-ee's example. That's the perfect one. I can see every future Buc-ee's having a bank of chargers, because Buc-ee's, you go in with the expectation that you're going to spend 25 minutes, because it's going to take you that long to pick out what beef jerky you want. And so you go and you charge while you're doing something else. And it seems like the perfect opportunity. Whereas I know when I travel, if I'm in a ICE vehicle, I'm just trying to get in and out and get rolling as quickly as I can. It will be a hindrance to widespread adoption in the United States unless charging becomes an enjoyable experience. And right now it's not.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you've looked at all, studied the design of gas stations and why they're set up. Because you mentioned early on that it, due to danger factors or whatever, they would oftentimes be on the curb. Because to me, one of the pinch points with EV charging is how they're designed, where you pull into a slot, right? And then you have to back out. And it's a very different experience than the pull-through design of gas stations. But maybe it wasn't always that way. Maybe it has evolved over time, and now we're at the end of the innovation, and this is the perfect system for gas, and we just haven't quite gotten there yet for EVs.
I've never seen a gas station that didn't have a pull-through model, ever. From the very beginning, it was the pull-through model. I've seen gas stations that would have different pumps on different sides because the gas tanks were never standardized. So sometimes you might have to do it differently. But when you mentioned gas station design, I know at Coke, as early as the mid-20s, there were guides that would teach a gas station how to best lay out everything that they're doing. So you have your tires are over here because that's going to attract your attention. And that's a service Coke always offered. We still offer it today. If you go to a Walmart, I'm sure some Coke person has been in there, and Pepsi probably too, competing, saying, okay, if you set end aisles up like this, you're going to attract more attention. We offered that marketing type service to the gas stations via these beautiful picture books. And it would be, okay, make sure you've got chrome here because chrome attracts attention. Make sure you've got XYZ over here, and you're going to sell more oil if you've got it neatly arranged to the left of the door. And a Coke machine will be on. It was prescriptive design on how to set up a gas station. As an EV user, I've never had an enjoyable EV charging experience. Can't tell you how many back of Walmart parking lots I've sat in.
And dangerous. You know. I mean, if I've traveled cross country or sections of the country, not completely cross country like Alex has, and nothing like a dimly lit parking lot in Walmart to
the back of the Myers at 11 at night.
Yeah, exactly. No,
it's And I've been there. And my wife actually commented on that. She's like, my God, if you weren't here, I'd be terrified being here by myself.
Yeah. So. To me, it's like the EV, electric vehicles and EV charging, like, needs a Coca-Cola of some, like, who is that? Who, they what just company need, they is just, that?
I don't know what company it is, but there's really smart people doing really smart marketing, and it won't take that long before somebody cracks the nut, you know, to combine the EV charging experience with something that is a positive experience, because you want to repeat positive experiences and you want to decrease unpositive experiences. It's just human nature. So I'm sure somebody smart's working on it right now as we speak. Hell, somebody at Ford is probably working on it. I haven't seen the fruits of it yet.
Yeah, given how affluent the EV buyer market is too, you'd think especially, right? Like, those are the, if you could get an affluent market, you know, affluent people specifically for 30 minutes of their time spending their money when they're captive, like, it just seems like a marketer's dream. So yeah, it is odd that you haven't seen more of that.
One would think. I'm curious, one of the big, you know, issues with charging networks that are not Tesla superchargers is the reliability of the chargers themselves. And there's, you know, been I think the progress line is up and to the right to improve that, but it's been slow. When the first fuel pumps appeared, you said they were gravity fed, so reliability is a non-factor. But at some point there, when they you added power, that had to be a factor. So after, what came after the gravity fed pumps? When did power get added to pumps and payment methods get maybe integrated? I mean, I don't really know what the milestones were, but were there ever reliability issues with gas pumps?
There were, I'm pulling up, I want to make sure I get these dates right, because I wrote a history of gas stations for an internal group. and
I think, mean, you've got a book there, right? You think you've got a book there.
No, I never write a book. That's part of why the archives exist, is to be able to do things like that. Shoot, I can't find it quickly and easily on my computer. But essentially, going from my memory, you had the gravity fed were the early aughts, and then after that you began to get the pumped one where it's in a pump under the ground and pumped into the car. That was the mid teens, about that same time period that Chevron is taking over. And then the massive standardization that took place. Ah, here we go. I found it. The early gravity fed prior to 1950, standardized 1922. Electric 1929, and then computing, where it actually tells you how many gallons it's distributed to, 1935. There, wow. Wanted to be accurate, which is completely different time period than you would think. So if you're speculating, or not really speculating too much, because it's probably going in the smaller containers, exactly how much gas you purchased until 1935, at which point that little meter's turning and it's telling you how many gallons you bought.
So if the interstate highway system didn't exist until the
50s. Yeah, the Eisenhower bill.
Eisenhower, okay. So the concept of – the notion of range anxiety in EVs is predicated on the concept of potentiality? Like, because roads are everywhere and ubiquitous today, we want to maximize the potentiality of what we can do in any given day, even though the reality is 20 to 30 miles a day for most people. But back 100 years ago, in the absence of the interstate highway system, dirt roads only, no matter how much range your car had, you could only get so far. So the missing, or the other factor then, is the ubiquity of stations. So when was there a critical mass of gas stations such that if you wanted to, you could go as far as you want without even having to consider finding a gas station?
By the 20s. Mid-20s to late 20s, there's a gas station on every corner. Not literally, you know, figuratively. Although people were taking cross-country trips. Edsel Ford took a famous one in 1915 in a Model T to prove that it could be done. You just had to plan your route accordingly and make sure that you filled up whenever you had the opportunity.
I'm sorry, my co-host, that you brought that up. Sorry, I have to cut off my co-host. Now that you brought that up, do you know how long it took him to drive cross country
in 1950. Oh my gosh. No, and I'm working with the Edsel and Eleanor Ford home because they're doing a display on it to open in 25, but I never actually asked how long it took. Probably a couple months.
Oh, are they? And will there be a party when they have the display? Because I know someone you should invite.
Many records.
All right, we'll defer that question to the end of this recording.
Yeah.
Go on, Kirsten and Ed.
I just wanted to give an anecdote. So my grandmother, who is no longer living, but was born in 1917, and she lived in New Jersey. Her father was a manager of a AM/PM. And he was a big adventure guy. And she told me stories of them, I believe, in a Model T at a very young age, going up on mostly dirt roads all the way up into almost the Canadian border, gas-powered vehicle. So that would have been, 1925 at that point, 24. So at least in her personal experience, it seemed like they were able to get to where they wanted to go by that time.
You could get anywhere. And the Model T was spectacular for that because it had the high wheelbase that would take these rutted roads and you barely felt bumps. If you go over brick pavers, if anybody drives on Michigan Avenue in Detroit, you hit the brick section that you really, but the Model Ts with their high wheelbase, you barely felt it at all. It was a great, great design of a car. But by the 20s, you can get gas just about everywhere. And then the Interstate Act, Eisenhower Blue Star Highway, made it even easier to get everywhere. But when in Atlanta, there was a Good Roads campaign that was taking place in that 1915 to 1916 time period. And groups of people associated with the AAA would drive through different cities and were advocating for better paved roads to connect the cities. It worked. We got our roads. Unfortunately, we got too many of them. And now it feels like.
Well, and it's one of the interesting roots of the whole range anxiety thing is that, like, because people mostly don't remember unless they have read some of the history, how fundamental that was to all kinds of car marketing. I mean, motorsport originally was just how fast can we get from one city to another, right? Or from one distance, it was cross country. It was measuring the practical utility of these vehicles to get you out of the small town or even the large city that you were in, because otherwise it was quite hard to even do that. And like, I think when you go back and you look at, motorsport and the marketing stunts that were all done to race other manufacturers to show, right? And Henry Ford was at the thick of this. This was how he marketed his companies in the earliest days. When you remember how baked into like our traditions and understandings of cars that is, I think the range anxiety stuff makes a little bit more sense as irrational
as
it is.
Now that Ed has dragged the elephant in the garage back into the podcast, let's just ask Ryan the big question. All right. So in 1915, Irwin Baker, AKA Irwin Cannonball Baker, drove a Stutz from cross country in 271 hours. And he was then hired by Gartner and a bunch of other manufacturers to set records in their vehicles to demonstrate range, reliability, and that internal combustion polluted less than horses and trains. So did Ford ever consider hiring Baker to do this since every other car company back then was doing it?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know that we did do cross country stunts, for lack of a better word. Even if you got Edsel Ford getting in a car, we did one going from Seward, Alaska to Nome, Alaska, showing that it was durable. If you could get a car through the wilderness of Alaska, it would go anywhere. I don't know that Ford used Baker. I'm going to have to take a pass on that one, but I'll research and get back with you.
Thank you, because I want to talk to you about that for hours and hours and hours and hours.
Well, I want to pivot the conversation just a little bit to gas station attendants, because I'm curious what the history is on that. When did, I grew up in an era, of course, where there weren't gas station attendants, except for unless you went to the state of New Jersey.
New Jersey, where they, yes.
Yeah, where they still do that. But
have they changed that law yet? Do they still have to pump for you?
Yeah, they still have to pump for you.
Yeah. So aside from that, when actually was a transition, historically speaking, from the attendant to just self-serve? Like, when was the tipping point? I'm sure there were early examples, but when and why? Why did it change?
Oh, I'm going from memory, so I may be off, but it was the late 60s, early 70s with the pump your own. It could have been earlier than that, but and this is going back into the Coca-Cola days, remembering the way that the marketing had changed, but it was attendance all the way up until the 60s, at which point you began to get more of the pump your own gas. So I'm going to have to kind of equivocate on that one.
Do you know
in Oregon,
what was
it was
driving?
Just last year.
do you know what was driving that change? Was it just a promotion
ease.
Or a ease? Yeah.
Ease. Whatever was going to make the customer feel more at home is what they were doing. I've driven through New Jersey and feel so awkward to have somebody come and pump my gas for me. But I remember, you know, I'm 60 years old. So in the 70s, I remember there were still attendants that you would, you know, in Atlanta, Georgia, that would get out and pump your car or you pump your gas. But we would always choose the ones where the stations where they didn't have to do that. Because dad hated it. It's like, I'm not going to let somebody pump my gas for me. So that
to me is an interesting arc though, where then, the gas, the internal combustion vehicle was so ubiquitous by the 60s and people had familiarity around the technology. And so therefore it made sense to transition. Whereas with EV charging, it has never started with an attendant or anyone like helping you or troubleshooting. So my experience very often is me calling the 1-800 number of the EV charging station to walk through whatever the problem is. And this is coming from a point of knowledge, a point of familiarity, knowledge, and even, you know, dare I say, expertise around EVs. And I just find it, that whole thing fascinating, that it never, ever has relied on attendance or anything like that. It's always been, the baseline was that the consumer will do it themselves and figure it out. I mean, I don't know why that started that way as opposed to how gas started.
I couldn't answer that either, but I know that, that in my experience with the chargers, it's almost been nothing but frustrating because of that, because of, it's not reading. I'm on, and I'll give a plug for Ford. The Ford Pass app is great for mapping me to stations that are in network, and then my credit cards are built in, so I don't have to worry about, well, this one in the thumb the other day wouldn't take the Ford Pass app, even though it was geared up to do it. So then I'm trying to swipe, you know, it was difficult to do. And I'm standing in the middle of nowhere in Bad Axe, Michigan, you know, trying to figure out how to get power to the car to get back home to Dearborn. Eventually we did figure it out, but it's awkward. And the other one on the gas station that changed the way everything works as well as that pay at the pump, which happened during our lifetime. You know, if you think about the way that it's evolved over time, you don't have to go inside and spend the money on the Coke and the Doritos anymore. You can just pay at the pump and swipe and get out. I can't tell you how many of the guides that Coke was publishing were talking about and stressing clean restrooms. Clean restrooms will make your, well, it's the truth. It does make it a more enjoyable experience. And you know, when we're traveling, we always pick places and truck stops that we think we're going to get a good experience. So anyway, that's a diversion.
Well, I know it's actually not a diversion, because when you go open the Tesla GPS, you're looking for stations, it'll tell you whether or not there's food, whether or not there's like amenities. And you often, and the experience is so inconsistent that it can get unpleasant, really unpleasant. And that's a core customer service function, is to guarantee consistency, hopefully, and quality. I like to ask a question that's not about EVs and charging, completely separate. Every company has stories that they want to tell that support like the current narrative, current product set, but they also have a vast archive of stuff that just doesn't see the light of day for whatever reason. There's too many stories to tell. What's the craziest Ford story that you can tell that hasn't seen the light of day?
Oh, I would have to say the origins of the GT, because everybody saw Ford versus Ferrari, which is a great movie, but it's an excellent work of fiction. There's not much reality in it. And the actual documents that we had that showed the development of the car in the 65 to 66 when we finally ran and won the race were just, it was a story of teamwork of Shelby American, Holman Moody, Allen Mann Racing, Ford Engine and Foundry, a critical group to it. And then there was a group called the Le Mans Committee that actually met in the Dearborn Inn on a biweekly basis from September until the actual race. And so, you know, the way the movie depicted it with the nothing could have happened without Shelby and Ken Miles. That's true. Shelby and Ken Miles had a great role, but they were in the Dearborn Inn meeting with Foundry and Engine and the other people. So the story they got out with the movie is not an accurate one. And I think the real story would have been just as compelling if it had that one been told. The other, we found a really cool document recently. We found the contract that was on Enzo Ferrari's desk that wasn't signed. And we've got it was with the telegram announcing the suspension of negotiations between Ferrari and Ford. So there's amazing stories, and they see the light of day when it makes sense, you know, and you know, companies are always trying to push a narrative, but as the historians and the archivists, you know, we know the backstories as well. My other favorite one is the goat mode on a Bronco. If anybody's driven a Bronco and you've seen that it has the different drive modes, it's called GOAT, goes over any terrain. That's because the original document that founded the Bronco program was for a goat feasibility study, not greatest of all time and not a billy goat, but goes over any terrain as Ford was trying to come up with something to compete with Jeep. So there's amazing stories that can be found in the archives.
So I have one last question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Question.
Oh, well, sorry, no, Kirsten, I just really quick. I'm just wondering if you've stumbled upon any hilarious patents for like designs that maybe ideas that just never quite made it, but are really interesting.
They're not springing to mind immediately, but one of the cafeterias at Ford that was being rebranded, they wanted to call it the Patent Center. And so we were going back through old patents for different materials and looking to see what some of the crazy ones are. One of my favorite, it's not a patent per se, but favorite Ford stories is that the little gas, we'll bring it home on gas, the little gas indicator, what side your tank is on, the little arrow pointing left or right to show which side you need to pull up to pump your gas. That was a Ford idea, and it was an employee submitted one, and the guy won $500 for submitting the idea. We actually have his little memo going, wouldn't it be convenient if there was an arrow next to your gas gauge to tell you what side of the car you needed, or what side of the car that would receive the gas, so you would know what side of the pump to go on.
Dumb question, but does every EV have such an arrow as well?
No.
Why not? No. Why not?
I pulled up to the wrong side of a Charger the other day.
Yep. And that's the simple things. It's the simple things that make so much sense that I'm not seeing happen as readily in the EV market. And I've got a Mach-E and a Lightning. I'm double downed on EV. So I'm speaking as someone who lives this on a daily basis. But the Lightning has, it looks like Charger ports on both sides, but one is not. One is a fake just to mimic the design or to make the design balance, where the Charger port's on the left side. So to me,
it's like, it's really interesting because obviously there's newer companies like Tesla doing the part of this now, but legacy automakers and EV startups are like, don't seem to have learned any of the lessons, like successes and failures from what happened in with gas powered engines and or cars. And they're just like ignoring all of that, which is really interesting to me. Like just simple things like how, for instance, what side the charging port is would seem like, oh, well, this isn't a new idea. It's actually being done with gas powered vehicles. So that's what's so kind of fascinating about the whole electrification push is that there's all sorts of lessons that they seem to be ignoring. And I don't know if it's just because, oh, hey, this is gas powered, so we're going to do it completely differently. And there's a reason to do that, I suppose, but there's also certainly a reason to like learn from that. So I'm curious when they're going to reach a point when they start going, oh, okay, this might make sense. Let's do this. Let's do this with gas stations, or apply some of the lessons from gas stations to EV charging stations, for instance.
It's not for lack of knowledge, because I've briefed the Model E team, and the Model E team has taken tours of the archives, and you know, we have our EV tour that we give, where we talk about the origins. There's a famous memo, well, not famous, you probably haven't heard about it. I should share it with you down the road. A 1967 memo committing $10 million to perfect an EV that could be sold within the UK market and the US market to work on the battery. The battery technology was falling behind it. So we've given these tours. I don't think anybody's found the magic pill to make it all come together. I fear that it's going to be the Chinese manufacturers who get it right more before the American ones do. So I'm sorry, Ed, I think you had more and more. I got to go.
Yeah, I have one last question, and hopefully it's not too big of a can of worms, but I've been really enjoying this conversation so, so much. I love learning from history and trying to apply it, you know, to puzzle through the challenges of today. It's like my favorite thing. And I think the Ford story says so much about the moment that we're in right now. In fact, I have this fantasy about when I finished some projects, of just going back and reading every book there is about the early days of Ford in particular. I'm wondering if your reading of the history of Ford, you know, has anything to offer companies of today, you know, lessons about that relationship between, you know, the importance of a really charismatic and popular founder and also the pitfalls of it. Because clearly it can be one of those things that can be, you know, the thing that makes a company happen at all, but also the thing that can endanger the company. And at some point, you know, the survival of a company kind of came down to, I think in the Ford case, to family members even kind of stepping in and kind of help easing into that transition. I'm just curious if there are any lessons that stand out to you from that history that might be useful to the companies of today.
I actually give a presentation on this very topic to the Ford leadership team in picking different examples. You're 100% correct. The Model T changed the world. The assembly line changed the world. The $5 a day wage and the 5-day work week, which was a Ford thing, changed the world. And then, like I mentioned, by the mid-teens, we're up to 57% of the world production of automobiles as a Model T. But Chrysler was quickly on the heels. GM surpassed us. Chrysler's on the heels. And by 1926, we're the number three automaker. So how did they lose it? Well, it was the calcification of the innovation at Ford. And it was because Henry Ford was focused on creating this novel engine called the X engine. It was going to be in the shape of an X. It was going to be a V8. And we spent, in today's terms, hundreds of billions of dollars on this stupid engine. He never got it working. It's a famous memo. It's at the Henry Ford Museum. Ernest Cantor was Edsel's brother-in-law. He wrote Henry and asked him to give up on the X and to develop a replacement for the Model T because GM was surpassing us. Believe it or not, guys, they had windows, and you had an enclosed cab on a Chevy. You know, some of the Model Ts are still tonneau tops, and you know, in Michigan, that's not great in December. And in reply, Henry Ford fired Cantor. We didn't do it. And then finally, Edsel stepped in and convinced Henry to scrap the T, and then Edsel designed the Model A. Henry got to put his ingenuity into some facets of it, and then the V8. He finally got a V8 right with 1932. But there were pitfalls like that, and it's the law of stagnation. If you don't grow, you're stagnant, and if you're stagnant, you're losing. And he had rested on his laurels with the Model T. And the management lesson that I give is we have to be looking at what's around the corner. You know, Robert Woodruff, the CEO of Coca-Cola for many, many years, 55 plus years, said it's easy to look in the valley; it's hard to see over the next hill. And that's what the best leaders do, is they try. And so for an EV standpoint, I know when Ted Kanis was in there, guys, I'm like, we have to figure out how to make our customers want our EVs. And if we don't, somebody else does, they're going to go buy them from them. And I think Ford Pro is an excellent example of using technology and charging and infrastructure and the knowledge to sell a product to make the customers' lives easier. We're doing it there, but we haven't cracked the nut yet on the consumer model. But I don't know that we can unless we build the chargers, and I don't think there's any appetite to take on the capital to build the charging network system. So, you know, we're chicken and egging it again, just the way we started our conversation.
Yeah. No, as you say, we're in the thick of some really fascinating history now, which makes going back and seeing what was happening 100 years ago so interesting and vital. So thank you so much.
We just talked an hour. I can't imagine I have anything left to say of interest. So.
You've got at least 100 hours left. Great. One of my favorite episodes ever. Ted, thank you for your time. And on that note, welcome to another episode of the Atomicast.